Chapter 8. To this day, I still don't know how the news stations do it. Maybe they have somebody sitting around, listening in on the police band radio. But somehow, they always seem to know when something significant is happening, anywhere in the city. Now, a murder was not significant. Not in a city that would see over 500 murders over the course of the year. During that hot summer, we'd see two or three a day, easy. But those were usually results of the gang wars, casualties in the fight for control of the drug trade. One black man killing another, whether you want to come right out and say it or not. That didn't make the 6 o'clock news with Bill Bonds. But a white woman from the suburbs found dead in the abandoned section of the old train station downtown, that was worth scrambling the trucks for, which is exactly what Franklin and I saw as we came back down the tracks. Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 7, they were all there. There were remote newscasters standing in front of cameras and lights, and there was crime scene tape strung all across the parking lot, from the station to the tracks, to keep everyone away from that back door. Sergeant Schumann was still on the scene. He already looked a little frazzled and ready to tee off on the next reporter who asked him a question.
"McKnight," he said as soon as he saw me. "Get down to the station ASAP."
"That's where I was heading." Nobody asked Franklin or me any questions as we ducked under the tape and headed out to the parking lot. They probably figured we were just two officers helping to secure the crime scene. Nothing special here. Let's go bug the sergeant again. I followed Franklin to our car. I sat in the passenger seat while he got behind the wheel. He didn't say anything as he started the car and headed out to Woodward.
"Tell me what kind of world we live in," he finally said, "where a woman gets killed just because she's wearing a diamond bracelet."
I shook my head. Did it even matter now? Was there a better reason that would make more sense?
"They call those eternity bracelets," he said. "Those bracelets with all the diamonds. They're pretty expensive."
I shook my head again. I didn't know anything about expensive jewelry. I'd come to find out that it was, in fact, an eternity bracelet, bought for Elena Page by her husband on their 5-year anniversary. A couple of years later, Chris Everett would stop a tournament to look for her bracelet, and that's how they'd come to be known as tennis bracelets. But that summer, they were still eternity bracelets, and if Elena's husband thought he'd have anything resembling an eternity to spend with his wife, he was horribly mistaken. The sun was going down when we got to the police station. It was already feeling like the longest day of my life. Sergeant Grimaldi was still there, and when he saw me, he put his hand on my shoulder and asked me how I was doing. It was a small gesture, but it meant a lot to me. It would be something I'd remember even after I left the police force.
"You're going to be pulled in about 5 different directions at once," he said to me. "But first things first. We've got all the current mugshots ready for you. You need to look through them carefully. If we're lucky, you'll spot the guy, and we'll have him in custody before the night is over."
He led me to one of the interview rooms. The mug books were there waiting for me. 4 faces per page, each face shown from the front and then from the side. I'd led my share of arrestees to the same wall against which these shots were taken. Now it was my turn to go through a tall stack of them. The hope was that the man I'd chased today had been arrested in the past, and that I'd be able to recognize him. Franklin came in after a while and asked me how it was going.
"Nothing yet," I said, pausing to rub my eyes. "You need some coffee?"
"That'd be great, thanks." I went back to the mugshots. He brought my coffee. Then he sat down across from me with his own cup.
"You don't have to stay here," I told him. "Your family must be wondering where you are." "I called them. They know I'm working on something important."
He wasn't really working on anything, of course. He was just keeping me company. But I didn't call him on it.
"You should talk to your wife, too," he said. "Let her know what's going on."
"I will. Next time I take a break. I think she might have class tonight anyway." A few minutes later, Sergeant Grimaldi stuck his head in.
"Any luck?"
"Not yet," I said.
"Detective Bateman would like to steal you for a few minutes," he said. "The family's still here, and he'd like you to talk to them."
I looked over at Franklin. The night was about to get even tougher. If you work in a police station in the heart of one of the most murder-prone cities in the country, you're going to see your share of devastated families. They get led into the room with that same look on their faces, helpless and drained of blood. They sit down. They hardly ever accept anything, no coffee or even water. They just sit there and wait for the nightmare to end. But it doesn't. They get shown a photograph taken at the crime scene, a close-up of the face from above, the eyes usually open. You need to prepare yourself for what you're about to see. That's the standard line, as if it's even possible. They take the photograph. Something goes out of them, like a sail losing its wind. There's no longer any doubt, but they still have to say it. They have to give you the verbal identification. Yes, that's him. That's my boy. 9 times out of 10, it's a male. I'm sorry for your loss. The next standard line. They hardly ever break down when they're in the station. They must save that for home. While they're here, they summon up the strength to keep it under control. It never fails to amaze me. The sergeant led me to another interview room just down the hall from where I had been going through the mugshots. He opened the door, and I stepped into that drywall box of absolute misery. The husband was sitting on one side of the table. He was wearing a golf shirt, and his hair was pressed down where he'd obviously been wearing his golf hat. I pictured 2 cops having to go out onto the course and find him, interrupting him right in the middle of his round to give him the news. Or maybe he was already done. Heading for home, heading for dinner with his wife. Now he was here in this room, looking down at a clear plastic bag on the table. I recognized the pieces of the diamond bracelet I had found. He was framing the bag with his hands, like he wanted to pick it up. I was sure the detective had told him not to touch it. Not until it had been processed for fingerprints. He kept staring at the bag, not even blinking when the door opened. The father and mother stood together behind him. The father was wearing casual clothes that looked expensive, the mother too. I didn't get a good look at her at first, because she stood with her face against her husband's chest. He stroked her hair, and otherwise had the same faraway look as his son-in-law. A young man sat in the corner by himself. More nice clothes, another blank stare. He was working his hands together, like he was getting ready to hit somebody. That left Detective Bateman. He was sitting at the far end of the table, writing in a notebook. He looked up as the door opened.
"Officer McKnight," he said. "Thank you. I'd like you to meet Tanner Page, Elena's husband. These are her parents, Mr. and Mrs. Grayson, and her brother Ryan."
The husband and the father looked at me. The mother kept her face hidden. The brother kept working at his hands and ignoring everything else in the world.
"You saw him," the husband said to me. "The man who did this."
I looked at Detective Bateman. He gave me a slight nod.
"I saw the man who we believe is the suspect," I said. "We're going to do everything we can to find him."
The husband wanted to say more, but he seemed to be struggling to find the right words. I was waiting for him to lash out at me, to ask me why I hadn't caught him.
"Can you tell me," he finally said, "I mean, why would anyone do something like this? For a diamond bracelet?"
"I don't know, sir. I'm sorry."
"I told her not to wear this down here. It was just asking for trouble."
I noticed the brother glancing up for one moment. He stared at the husband, then closed his eyes and went back to working his hands together.
"You need to find him tonight," the father said, still stroking his wife's hair. "He could be 1,000 miles away by the morning."
"Yes, sir. Like I said, we're going to do everything we can."
"It's something we don't usually have," Bateman said. "A police officer who will be able to give us a positive ID when we catch him. And we will catch him. It'll be an airtight case."
"Like that'll do any good,"
the brother said, finally speaking up.
"Some gangbanger goes away for life. Is that going to bring her back?"
His mother looked at him, taking her face away from her husband's chest. Her face was ruined with tears, and there was a great stain on her husband's shirt.
"Ryan, please," his father said. "Of course it won't bring her back, but at least
At least what?
He has to pay. Whoever did this, I'll spend the rest of my life making sure he pays for this.
The brother waved this away, getting to his feet and starting to pace up and down his side of the room like a caged animal. I watched him, waiting for him to punch the wall, or something. I wouldn't have blamed him for anything at that point. I honestly could not even imagine going through what these people had to go through that night.
This isn't happening,
the husband said. He was still staring at the bracelet in the plastic bag.
I'm going to wake up and she'll be right there, next to me.
It's happening,
the brother said.
It's happening because you can't even walk down the street in the city anymore. Why the hell would you even let her take a class at Wayne State, for God's sake? Some ghetto school in the middle of the worst city in the world.
The husband was looking at him now. In about 2 more seconds, the brother would launch himself over the table, and we'd have a full-blown melee on our hands.
This is not helpful,
Bateman said. He stood up and put himself in the brother's way. He grabbed both of the young man's shoulders and looked him in the eyes.
Let go of me!
You need to calm down. You need to respect everyone else in this room, and you need to let us try to solve this horrible crime.
The brother seemed to run out of steam then. He dropped his head and brought one hand to his face. He started to cry. Bateman hugged him. It was not something you were supposed to do in a case like this, but as soon as he did, I could see it was the right play. The brother cried for a while, and then he stopped. He sat back down in the chair.
Officer McKnight, he said to me, I know you have work to do. I'm glad you got the chance to meet the family. The next time you see them, I hope it'll be when we tell them we've made an arrest.
I'm sorry for your loss, I said to everyone else in the room. One of those standard lines, you say, but I couldn't think of anything else. Then I went back to the mugshots. Franklin left for home eventually. I thanked him for everything he'd done that day.
Just doing my job, he said.
I kept looking through the mugshots. Detective Bateman came in a while later. His tie was loose. His eyes were red. It was the first time I'd ever seen him looking like something less than a human dynamo.
I take it you don't have an ID yet, he said to me.
He sat down in the chair Franklin had just vacated.
I'm afraid not. Then we need to get the sketch artist in here, get this down on paper while it's still fresh in your mind.
I can't believe this guy hasn't been in the system before, I said, flipping through more pages. He gave me a pretty stone-cold look on the other side of that fence, like he was about to laugh in my face.
Jeans and a gray shirt. Nothing on the shirt. No logos or anything.
No, plain gray. He did have an Oakland Raiders hat on. Bateman nodded.
That's how you do it if you're street smart. No markings, no weird hair. A hat you can throw away in a second. Just blend right in.
Are you telling me he's so smart we've never had him in the system before?
That would be just our luck, he said, rubbing his eyes.
Why cut her up so bad? I said, the scene at the station coming back to me, whether I wanted it to or not. I knew it would be there in my head forever.
What do you mean? He wanted her dead.
This is way beyond wanting someone dead. This guy destroyed her. He thought about that one.
We'll never know why he did that. Not until we catch him. Even then.
Any idea why Elena Page was at the train station in the first place? That's a long way from the college.
Her car was in the parking lot. The crime scene guys found a camera bag about 10 feet from the body. Nice camera inside, but it was damaged when it hit the floor.
Why leave the nice camera if you're already stealing her jewelry?
Too hard to carry, I guess? Or too obvious if you're trying to blend into the crowd?
So she was a photographer, you're saying?
Well, she was taking a photography course at Wayne State, at least. Maybe she figured she could get some great shots at the old train station.
I thought you handled things well with the family, I said. The brother was about to go off.
You realize, he said, that you belong to me now, until we catch this guy. I'll clear it with your sergeant.
Anything I can do, of course.
He nodded. I'll let you keep looking. Let me know if you get a hit. I'm not going anywhere.
Neither was I. Another hour passed, maybe two.
It was hard to tell at that point. I had gone through all of the mugshot books. I hadn't found my man. They got the sketch artist in, and we worked out a sketch. Problem was, although I could still picture him exactly in my mind, the sketch came out looking like a young black man with high cheekbones and a short afro. In other words, like half the male population in the city. We tried refining it, but in the end, we had to send out what we had. 5'10", 170 pounds, muscular build. Jeans, gray shirt with a torn right sleeve, basketball shoes. Last seen fleeing north on Trumbull Avenue. We sent it to every precinct in the city, and to every neighboring suburb. We sent it to the Michigan State Police. We sent it to the FBI. Elena Page had now been dead for 6 hours. It was going on 11 o'clock when I finally left the station. I had processed an official statement describing everything I had seen and done. I had tried to eat some dinner. I had gone back over the mugshot books. Detective Bateman told me to go home, to get some rest, and to be back at the station early in the morning. We'd see if we picked up any hits on the bulletin overnight, and then go from there.
"We'll start working the neighborhoods," he said. "Somebody saw this kid. I promise you that."
"I hate the fact that he'll sleep in his own bed tonight."
"Let him sleep. Let him believe he got away. If he does, he won't leave town, or he won't hide. Either way, we'll get him."
I said goodnight to the detective, and to all of the 4 to midnight shifters I saw on the way out. They were almost done with their day. Mine had lasted 15 hours. I got in my car. I had an 8-year-old Chevy Celebrity back then. About all I could afford on a Detroit cop's salary, with a wife who had quit her job to go back to school. I started driving down Woodward to hit that freeway that would loop me back through the city and then west to Redford. But then I blew right by the on-ramp and cut over to Corktown. I drove by the stadium one more time. A dark gray monolith now. I drove up Trumbull, daring my man to be outside walking around in the night air, confident that he'd gotten away with his crime today. I slowed down whenever I saw someone, usually 2 or 3 of them at a time, smoking cigarettes, drinking beer, staring back at me in my civilian car. I didn't see the man I was looking for. I got home at midnight. I lived in a little brick house on a block of little brick houses, in one of the original Detroit suburbs, now a working-class enclave for folks like me, who didn't want to live in the city itself, but didn't have the money to move out to Livonia or Dearborn Heights. I parked the car in the thin little driveway that ran between my house and the house next to me. I got out and took a breath. The dog was barking next door, just like every other time I came home. I went inside, took off my clothes, and lay on the bed without turning the lights on. I could hear Jeannie breathing on the other side of the bed.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I forgot to call you."
She didn't say anything for a while. I thought maybe she was asleep.
"I was worried," she finally said. "You promised me you'd call if you were going to be late. You remember?"
"There was a murder. A woman who's taking classes at Wayne State. Her name's Elena Page. Do you know her?"
"Doesn't sound familiar, no."
"She was taking a photography class."
Another few moments of silence. The dog stopped barking.
"Who killed her?"
"Some kid. 17, 18 years old."
"Did you catch him?"
"No, not yet."
That was the last thing I said before I closed my eyes. There was nothing else to say anyway. In my dreams, I was standing over the dead body again, but a strong wind was blowing through the building. Then I was chasing the young man in the jeans and gray shirt again, chasing him and never catching him down a set of railroad tracks that went on forever.